On the agenda, I think, are three topics from the Interpretation Committee. There are two specific issues, one overview of the Interpretation Committee activities. I don't know who will start.
I'll just give a brief introduction.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, then we start with the overview from April.
What we'd like to do today, as we said, is that we'd like to talk to you about two technical issues and also give you an update. The first thing we'd like to talk to you about is the measurement of investments in associate and joint ventures, and Takashi Yamagami will take you through that.
Okay, so the first question we would like to discuss with you relates to our application of requirements in IAS 28 and IFRS 9. So the purpose of this session is set out in slide 3. We would like to receive input from you on your experiences with dealing with long-term interests that are included in the net investment for the purpose of measurement requirements in IAS 28, that is, loss allocation and impairment in IAS 28. And now if you could turn to slide 4, there are a set of accounting requirements in IFRS 9 and IAS 28. So the first, IFRS 9 says that interest in associates and joint ventures that are accounted for using equity method are not included in the scope of IFRS 9, which means that accounting requirements in IFRS 9, such as classification and measurement, including impairment, are not applicable to those interests. IAS 28, on the other hand, requires that an entity's net investment should be subject to an allocation of losses and an impairment under IAS 28. And this impairment requirement in IAS 28 uses impairment indicators that are now included in IAS 39. And if there's any objective evidence that the net investment is impaired, then the entities would have to use the impairment guidance included in IAS 36. And this net investment includes ordinary equity shares accounted for using the equity method, and also long-term interests that form part of the net investment. And these interests are explained in IAS 28 as any long-term interest for which settlement is neither planned nor likely to occur in the foreseeable future. Examples of these long-term interests include preference shares, long-term loans and receivables, but they do not include trade receivables or trade payables or secured loans. And with respect to these accounting requirements, the question was raised, which is on slide 5. So should these long-term interests and associates included in the net investment be subject to IFRS 9 impairment, IAS 28 impairment, or both of them? And should they be measured at amortized cost under IFRS 9 if they meet the amortized cost classification requirements or using the equity method? And the views put forward by the submitter and discussed by the Interpretations Committee in September are included in slide 6. So there are four views, and on the bottom of the slide 6 there's a table which illustrates which part of the accounting requirements are applicable under each view. And in view A, this suggests that these long-term interests are entirely in the scope of IFRS 9, subject to IAS 28 loss allocation. And under view B, these long-term interests are entirely in the scope of IFRS 9 and also in the scope of IAS 28 impairment. So under this view, these long-term interests are subject to two impairment models. And under view C, it suggests that the long-term interests are entirely in the scope of IAS 28. So any of the accounting requirements in IFRS 9 would not be applicable under this view. And view D suggests that these long-term interests are in the scope of IFRS 9 for classification and measurement, but do not include IFRS 9 impairment requirements. instead the impairment requirements in IAS 28 would be applicable to these long-term interests. And after discussing these views, the Interpretations Committee noted that the feedback from the outreach indicated that there are divergent views on how to apply the impairment requirements with respect to these long-term interests. And it also noted that the interaction between IAS 28 and IFRS 9 was not clear. Consequently, the Interpretations Committee thought that an amendment would be required to clarify the issue. And it also noted that in doing so, any amendment would have to clarify the interaction between the accounting requirements in IAS 28 and IFRS 9, in particular how amortized cost accounting would work with allocation losses and impairments under IAS 28. So when the Interpretations Committee discussed this issue in September, it focused on amortized cost financial instruments because that was the assumption included in the submission. And also the Interpretations Committee thought that there would be more interaction issue with respect to that kind of financial instruments. However, we thought it would be worthwhile to understand what types of financial instruments are included in the net investment and how those financial instruments would be classified under IFRS 9. And we thought it would be a further opportunity for us to gain that understanding by asking you questions. So the questions we'd like to ask you are on slide 7. So the first question, in your experience, what types of long-term interests are included in the net investment besides ordinary common shares? Are they interest-bearing loan, non-interest-bearing loan, preferred shares, financial instruments with a conversion feature, or something else?
I think it's a very specific issue.
And we were lucky because we had this issue last year. So the way that we approached it was that our long-term loans to the associate were all non-interest bearing. So we had a problem between IAS 39 and discounting that at a rate. We also had a problem with the tax jurisdiction that if the contract said that it was long-term, then back onto Pat's argument, I wasn't able to redeem any cash because I hadn't hit a trigger date for when cash could be redeemed. So we deliberately set up our contracts as an on-demand basis. Because it was a foreign asset as well, I then in the separate, I'm recording the foreign currency loss in the income statement, but on consolidation, because it's part of my net investment, the foreign currency loss is flipped into the cumulative translation adjustment. When it came to booking the impairment, we booked it against the equity first. There was inherent goodwill also in this associate. So it had everything. We booked it against the equity first, and therefore effectively have stopped goodwill ever reversing when the impairment can reverse, principally because it was treated the equity as the first residual to absorb losses, and the loan as the later one, also because of the exchange control restrictions. If I'd written off the loan first because of the exchange control restriction, I'd never been able to repatriate cash. So I had to go the equity route as well. So it's not a simple accounting answer. There's legal situations if you're into cross-country in this as well.
So interesting.
Where am I? Think,
I would say that the answer depends on the real economic situation of the shareholding that we have. As a banker, this is a very frequent situation, in fact, because we accompany our customers when doing a loan by what we call participation by a shareholding of buffer, maybe 10-20%, depending on the situation of the corporate. So if we are the only one lender, in that case, we are not exactly in the same situation as if we share the loans with other shareholders of the company. And in that case, we would not appreciate the situation the same way. If we share the loan with other shareholders on a sort of pari passu situation, in that case, we would consider the loan as the equity instrument, in fact, or like, because in fact, it's the, if the corporate is in a bad situation, there will be probably a solution where we have to transform the loan in equity. So the net investment is composed of the of both instruments. If we are in the other situation, where we are the only one banker, suppose, or we have wanted all the loans the company needs, in that case, we would appreciate the situation differently and probably apply IFRS 9 and IS 28 36 on the two different instruments. So it's really a question of facts and circumstances. And also, a criteria is, do we have a real influence on that company as a shareholder for both instruments we have with the company? Thank you.
But if you didn't have influence, it wouldn't be an associate. I mean, you think you have a different kind of assessment from the assessment of whether you've got significant influence.
But you might have, you've got influence on the board, but not influence on compelling equivalent reinstatement or repayment of the loan. You can't accelerate yourself as a consequence of the influence.
Welcome.
Perhaps just a point of clarification. As you see, I had to go and get the actual standard to understand what it says. So paragraph 38, I'm not sure if other, perhaps it's in the minds of other people, but it wasn't in my mind. Losses recognized using the equity method in excess of the entity's investment in ordinary shares are applied to the other components of the entity's interest in an associate or joint venture in the reverse order of their seniority, i.e. priority in liquidation. So that, I guess, would speak to
different
what Kevin
to what
did.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just, perhaps I'm a bit sick here, but I don't quite understand what you've actually written here. Entirely in the scope of IFRS 9, subject to, do you mean it's the residual of that after you've written down, so let's say you've got a loss-making subsidiary and you've fully written off your equity, then if there weren't any other loans, you wouldn't have anything else to write down. But because you've got these long-term loans, you start to write down those loans because you've got losses. So it's then it's the residual amount of that loan on your balance sheet that you then would use for you then need to think using IFRS 9 for. But I'm a little bit confused when you say entirely in the scope of IFRS 9. It's not actually entirely. It's the, am I being pedantic here? It's the residual on your balance sheet that you would then look to IFRS 9 to value. Am I being stupid here?
Well,
I just don't quite understand the mechanics of what you've put into this chart.
Sorry, Malcolm, I think what our auditors have made us do is we can't even go down the proportionate basis once we've written off the equity. We have to be on the assumption that we still will stand behind the entity first, and the third party creditors will get paid in full, and we'll continue to take residual interest, which I think is wrong, because if you're going to liquidation, you should be on a equivalent basis. But we've had to do our accounting on the.
So my
reading that paragraph that you've given there, saying, assuming that you will stand behind the associate.
I think the question is regarding if you are in a loss situation, if you have to allocate real losses because your equity interest is already gone, I think that is clear, then you have to do it, I think, for that. But the question is here more, if you do an impairment, and is this impairment test based on the rules for in IFRS 9. So do you have really to do now in the future do an expected loss model for this kind of loan to the entity, or can you do it based on the normal impairment rules which you do your equity stake? I think that's the question. And if it is entirely in IFRS 9, I think you have to do the impairment test based on the rules in IFRS 9 with an expected loss model. And you can then ask the question, but is it then in addition to that? Is it both? Or what do you have to do? And I think in the past it was not so difficult, because I think if you do an impairment test, it was an incurred loss model under IAS 39 was very similar. If you do it, I think, under the equity method, if you do an impairment, and but now with IFRS 9 going to an expected loss model, I think that situation is more difficult. And if you would conclude you have to do an impairment test under IFRS 9, I think you have to introduce the expected loss model.
Let's take an example. You've written off the equity and you've got a loan of 100, but because you've allocated some extra losses to that 100, you've written that loan down to only 80. So it's the 80 that you would then need to assess either under IFRS 9 or under a different model. Is that what we're talking
about?
That is
in your situation,
it's the 80 that you're
focusing. Your situation is...
So it's not, it's I'm being pedantic here, it's the residual amount that's not written down under...
Yeah, but it could also be if you are not in a loss situation. If you're still in a not loss situation, then it also you have this question. Do you have to perform an impairment test for this loan under IFRS 9, or do you have to look everything together, so the equity stake and the loan, and do an impairment test on the rules under IAS 28? And that is, I think, really the question. It's not only in the situation what you are now focusing on the loss situation.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Sandra.
I think it... Going back to what Gerard had said, there's some facts and circumstances that could drive you in one direction versus another. And in our situation, when we have a big project and we need financing, oftentimes we co-lend because our cost of borrowing is much cheaper than what the project could get. So I think we might have a different conclusion in that situation than one where we're just financing an operation on an ongoing basis. So I do think there are some facts and circumstances that could drive you in different directions.
Doesn't appear we're giving you particularly clear guidance.
No, but I think Gerard made a very good point, as well as did Kevin, which is that the nature of the investment, the nature of the instrument, I think will essentially, I think hopefully, drive the economics, and then perhaps the accounting will be more clear. So in the example where you have a secured interest and you have rights pursuant to that secured interest, in my mind, that militates more clearly for treating that, you know, as a debt instrument separate and apart from your equity investment. That's my personal view. Whereas if it's not, if it doesn't have those embedded rights in the indenture, or the note agreement, the credit agreement, and it's more kind of an additional long-term investment, then I could see potentially a different outcome to the assessment. So, you know, that may necessarily might not make it abundantly clear, but I think that kind of division or line is something I could live with from a usefulness, you know, of information. But I guess we'll have to hear what everybody else has to say.
Okay. So the second question I wanted to ask was how the long-term interest will be classified under IFRS 9. And what I'm hearing is the long-term interest that the entities would extend would depend on facts and circumstances. And so the classification would also depend on those facts and circumstances, and it could be classified as amortized cost and a fair value through profit or loss.
It would be exceptionally useful, but you're not reopening IFRS 9. Those type of instruments do more clearly get scoped into I is 28. You know, because you might have an intention for it to be long term, but contractually, as in our case, it has to be short term. Otherwise, I hit exchange control problems. But I'm never going to apply that short term rule because I need to leave that funding there to maintain the business. So you end up with a contract that says one thing, but an intention that's another. And that dichotomy causes problems for auditors.
I'm not sure it's very helpful, but I mean, IAS 28 is a very old standard and is anyway perhaps subject to review. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, that following perhaps what Pat was saying, that there might be circumstances where sometimes these things you perhaps need to work on the phrasing of IAS 28 and slightly amend it somehow so that you could have circumstances where sometimes these loans are really part of the net investment,
right,
and in other cases you would allow them to be normal financial instruments outside of. So don't you almost have to, so perhaps what I'm saying is, don't you have to have a limited amendment to IAS 28 to clarify this? If one wants to have two possible scenarios, somehow you have to put wording around to capture what is part of the net investment and what is just as a financial instrument.
Yeah, and I think even the question is if you have it part of the net investment.
Frank.
Yeah. Frank, maybe you go first.
Yeah, sorry. We have a lot.
It's very difficult to understand. You can.
Tax reasons. Sorry. Can you hear me better?
Yeah, it's better now.
We have lots of these long-term, five-year type interest-bearing loans, interest-bearing for tax deductibility. But it clearly falls within the revised 28 purposes of Boston. So I would avoid what Malcolm just said, and that is those that we view as really financial in IFRS 9 not somehow being caught up in the discussion, because they equally are part of it.
I think he was saying that if it is a pure IFRS 9 instrument, it should be in IFRS 9.
Yeah. What I'm hearing is maybe we have two things. We have, okay, we have to distinguish between is it for which purpose is this kind of loan, but secondly, also if it is kind of part of this long-term investment, then you still have the question,
yeah,
okay, how do you calculate, for example, amortized cost? What is the interest? What is effective interest based on that? Because I think then, in IAS 28, it is only, I think, referring to the impairment, but not for the rest of this instrument, how is it accounted for? And I think that is also, I think, part of your second question. And okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think then.
Not very conclusive.
Not very conclusive, but I think it is a.
Let's have a go then with Koichiro Kuramochi on testing of PP&E.
Thank you, April. Good morning, everyone. The next topic is IAS 16, accounting for proceeds and cost of testing of PP&E. So this issue was discussed at the March 2015 GPF meeting, and this session is to provide update at the Interpretations Committee discussions. And please keep in mind that this topic is still in very early stage, so that is why the approaches we are talking about in these slides are just preliminary potential approaches. So that's something I wanted to mention first. Having said that, we think this is very beneficial to hear feedback from the GPF, because the accounting for PP&E is fundamental and could affect various industries. So let's move on to the page 10. Briefly recap, what is the issue? IAS 16 provide some guidance which costs should be included in the PP&E when company construct PP&E. And one of the costs is cost of testing. And the paragraph 17E of IS 16 is saying that costs of testing whether the asset is functioning properly after deducting the net proceeds from selling any items produced while bringing the asset to the location and condition. So saying that if during the testing phase you have certain proceeds, maybe by selling samples, something like that, and then that proceeds should be deducted from the asset. Then the interpretations committee received question. The submitter noted that some companies received proceeds, that is material, and the material amount of proceeds are deducted from the asset. And the submitter questioned how to clarify what kind of proceeds can be deducted from the asset. And we think that it's the fundamental question is how to make sure narrowness of the deduction of proceeds from the PP&E. And we understand that the US GAAP does not explicitly allow deducting revenue. So basically, US GAAP does not allow any deduction of the proceeds from the PP&E. And I remember in the last GPF meeting, some comments are made on the US GAAP point. And still, in the interpretations committee, some interpretations committee member prefer this approach. At the same time, the interpretations committee is trying to explore other approaches to clarify the narrowness of the deduction of the proceeds. Let's move on to the slide, page 11. So the diagram is trying to show how to draw the line to clarify the deduction of the PP and deduction of the proceeds from the PP&E. So this is the timeline of the construction of the PP&E. And on the red line, at a certain point, the asset becomes ready for use. So asset becomes capable of operating in the manner intended by management. And then deduction of the proceeds would stop, and the proceeds would be recognized on income statement as a revenue. And also depreciation starts. At the same time, before the asset becomes capable of operating, company could receive proceeds. And if that is from the necessary activity, and also if there is testing, the IS 16 is clear that the proceeds would be deducted from the asset. That's the blue circle. And also, another thing which is clear on the IS 16 is that if the activity is not necessary to construct asset, the proceeds are treated as incidental revenue and they will go to P&L. However, it is not that clear if the proceeds are received from necessary activity, but that is not relating to testing, how to account for the proceeds. So that's something Interpretations Committee is trying to clarify. And one approach is drawing the line when an asset becomes capable of operating. That's the issue one on the red line. And the other line we could draw is trying to determine the meaning of testing and limit deduction of proceeds to only those relating to testing before asset becomes capable of operating. And these two potential approaches I'd like to explore on the slide 12 and 13. So slide 12 is talking about what kind of potential guidance we could create to clarify when the asset becomes capable of operating. And tentatively, we are exploring is if we could provide some guidance that asset is capable of operating. If it is capable of producing the intended item that can be sold in the ordinary course of business on a regular basis. So basically, this paragraph is saying that if the proceeds are coming from the ordinary revenue, that cannot be deducted from the asset. So that's the approach one. And on the slide 13, we are talking about the other option or approach on the issue two. So in order to clarify the meaning of testing, the potential way of clarifying testing is provide guidance that functioning properly on the IS 16 paragraph 17E is that which reflect the technical and physical performance of the PP&E and not financial performance. So test the meaning of testing is testing the technical or physical performance, and the company cannot wait the achieving a certain level of operating margin, something like that. So that kind of clarification could be made. That's the other approach interpretations committees are exploring. On the page 15, there are questions to GPF members. The first question is, do you have any comments on the next steps identified by the interpretations committee? And also, other questions are, we are considering developing guidance on the following matters. One, potentially providing guidance for the capable of operating in the paragraph 20 of IS 16. And also providing clarification on the meaning of testing in paragraph 17 of IS 16. And if you have any comments on the potential guidance on paragraph, page 12 and 13, we would appreciate to hear that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could I just ask a quick question on the wording, actually, Kurichi Rosai?
Please.
When we talk about the regular basis on the proposed amendment, is it producing on a regular basis or selling on a regular basis? I'm not sure of the significance.
Producing on the regular basis, right. Yeah.
Chair.
Just a word, because as a banker, I'm not really concerned with this. I would just like to do a parallel between financial instruments and these type of instruments. For financial instruments, the intent of the management is something that we try to avoid. We speak about business model that is observable, but we don't want to have an accounting or intention accounting. And here, what struck me is that we consider that it is the intention of the management in the way the product is operating that is the threshold. So I wonder why we have two different directions considering financial instruments and other instruments.
I see. I think that's a very good point. IS 16 is very old standard and a very principle-based standard, I would say. The current wording on the page 10, I copied the wording from the paragraph 20. The guidance already provided in IS 16 is quite principle-based. So when an item is in the location and the condition necessary for it to be capable of operating in the manner intended by management, that's it. So I totally understand. And it could help to provide more guidance to achieve the consistency of the practice.
Just to reemphasize what Gérard has said, I think intention by management, for me, it's not properly the it's not the proper, you know, the right element to define whether an asset is in a state of operation or not. I think, you know, in our industry, there is always what we call first industrial production. There is some type of, in French, procès-verbal, statement from the technicians that the plant is in a state of operation. So it's a technical decision which really triggers the fact, because behind this we've got safety issues, you've got permit issues. So it's never intention of management. It's essentially, a technical facts, technical factors, which are again translated into some type of statements. So that's number one. Number two, we've got also the issue on the sales, because sometimes an asset is linked to a contract. And you know, testing and other proceeds is also a gray area, because you know, when does the testing actually end? So you may decide that it has ended, but you come, maybe you've got the statement of first industrial production, and you come with additional issues that you are not expected initially. So the testing period may last longer than what you expected. So I think it's not, you know, there's not a line, you know, very clear line on when does testing actually stop. Mm-hmm. So, and it's probably difficult to put in wording exactly what is the ending period of a test. So I think we need to bit of a flexibility which linked to the actual operations of the asset. And for me, the critical issue is the cost. You know, it's the issue, when do you start to depreciate? Because, and what level of margin, you know, do you recognize, when you just book other proceeds? Because, you may have a proceeds, it happens in our plants, that we produce much lower quantities than the nominal level of quantities. And maybe the contract with a customer, we've got long-term contract, does not start because there is also an intermediate period. So it's other proceeds, not the long-term contract. And then we need to define what cost do we put against the proceeds. And I feel, for me, a much more critical issue than just the measurement of the proceeds. So be careful not to be too simplistic in the arguments you use, because it's probably much more complicated in practice than what you may say.
Thanks for that.
Can I just ask Jacques a question? So would it be reasonable to say that the time when you stop deducting it from the cost is also the time when you start depreciating?
No, we do not do it, because we've got the issue, and when does it's also a negotiation with a customer. When does the contract for the full quantities start? Because if we produce only maybe 10% of the nominal capacity of a plant, it does not make sense to fully amortize that plant. So we've got always discussions with the auditors on this point. And usually we've got long-term contracts. So, and then there is a period when we start to charge, in our case we've got very often take or pays, when we start to charge the take or pays. And we will start the full depreciation when we start to charge the take or pay to the customer.
Kevin?
What we have, what we pay attention always to is the level of margin we recognize during this period of other proceeds. We never want to have a huge margin compared to the level of margin we will have when the plant actually is in full operation.
So I think my conclusion reading all this, it's really a unit of account question, as opposed to what is testing. Because if you can, depending on how detailed you are in componentization, it's relatively easy to determine when the component's in use. But if your level of componentization is quite broad, then there might be subcomponents of the major component that are in use. And so in our case, we don't consider the level of margin. We'll bring a mine into operation which is on negative margin, because mines have to produce some element of inventory in their intervening process before they ramp up. And so once we've got to an item that we are now classifying as inventory on the balance sheet, then we commence depreciation. But then we componentize a mine quite greatly. So the roads, which you first initially have to build, are in use purely because you have to build the road to get to the pit to get the truck there. It all ends up in the next stage of mine development, but so we end up with this ever-increasing depreciation that's recapitalized, but we go through that process in order to get the components right and write the asset off over its real useful life in a component basis, but not necessarily in the income statement. It just moves, shift, and say, once you get your unit of account right, I think the testing's easy. But it's that unit of account and componentization that's your critical number. And that's, you know, that's not what you're answering here.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, but thank you very much. That's a very good point. Thank you.
Cool.
We have a little bit similar problem in the paper industry, where the intention may be to produce a certain product, a certain grade. And in the beginning, the testing, you produce something else. Perhaps you can sell it, but that was absolutely not the intention.
Right.
I have experienced once when we produced a board, and first the testing, and then it should be certified by the customer before he accepted. We produced like 100,000 tons before we had the certification. And we booked that inventory at variable cost. Just for raw material cost, because it was only pulp that we could reuse, or we could sell it as pulp.
Right.
But I have another question that may be not the same issue in a way, but in some cases, assets today in some businesses are bought related to usage. If you invest in something and you don't utilize more than, because you pay 100 upfront to have a certain issue, the supplier supplies something that has a much bigger capacity. When you have come to a utilization rate of about 50%, you have to pay more. Normally people start to depreciate the first installment, I think, and then when they pay the extra, they start to depreciate the second payment, and that is not directly what you say here, in a way. That's another issue.
Ah, right. That's different, I'd say. Yeah.
But I think that is a part of it as well.
Yeah, could it be related? Yeah, thanks. Thank you. I really appreciate if you could take a look at underlined paragraphs on page 12 and 13, and if these clarifications could cause any problem in the practice.
Kevin?
In that underlined on paragraph 12, I think I have a concern as to whether I'm a vertically integrated single entity or a group. Because if I'm a vertically integrated single entity, I actually have no intention of selling the process as it comes up the chain, and therefore does can be sold mean that, well, theoretically you could divert it out that way. You're never going to, because you actually need it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm in a group, because I'm naturally on selling to my next subsidiary,
I see.
I end up with two different accountings, whether I'm vertically integrated to single entity or group, and that doesn't make sense.
Definitely. That's also the unit of accounting issue. Right, thanks.
Olivia?
I just have difficulty to understand the wording about functioning property reflects the technical physical performance of the PPA, that I understand. And not the financial performance. What is it?
So the wording was intended to classify what's the testing of the physical asset of the PP&E. That the interpretations committee's discussion was that testing should focus on physical capability, I would say, and if management weight to achieve certain margin, let's say the throughput rate is low or throughput achieved a certain level to create certain margin, that would not qualify testing. So that's the thinking behind here.
I think that was what Chuck said. That, okay, if the techniques say, okay, that is now
right.
Operation and not the controller saying it is not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think last 5 minutes we have an update on other interpretation committee issues.
Yeah. Yes, just very quickly, on slide 17.
No, let you do the introduction. I have a comment.
Okay. I was going to say, I wasn't going to speak very much, actually, so that we can catch up in time. On slide 17, we've got a project on very specific conditions with respect to available for sales instruments and deferred tax. On slide, that's actually not likely to be published in Q4. We, as Hugh mentioned earlier, we have got a number of documents on the board's agenda, and some of these implementation issues may be held back so that we don't overwhelm people. Slide 18, we're re-deliberating two narrow scope amendments, one on share-based payment and one on the classification of liability and debt. And their comment letter analysis is likely to go to the board either this month or next. On slides 19 and 20, we've got four projects which we, the two on 19, which were interpretations, they were published on the 21st of October. They are now out for comment until the 19th of January. And the two issues on slide 20, we will be publishing, hopefully, either in Q4 or in Q1 of next year. Annual improvements, again, that is in the process of being finalized and is likely to be published soon. Just for information, on slide 22, we put down the items which will be going into annual improvements in future years, so we haven't started finalizing those yet. And then on the subsequent slides, 23 and 24, we just list things where the Interpretations Committee are looking at these topics. 25. Some issues that we've had in which we haven't started work on, and then on slide 26, topics that have been rejected by the Interpretation Committee. Do you have any comments or questions on the individual projects?
So, April, on slide 19, so the top point there. Did you say that interpretation has now been issued, or it's
it was issued on the 21st of October, and it will be out for comment until the 19th
of
January.
Of January, okay.
Yeah.
Because I think with that solution you're proposing, if I read it correctly, there might be some systems issues, and in as much as you know, it's going to hear you. You're saying if you have a prepayment in a foreign currency, then do I understand that right? Then the later sale would have to be recorded at that exchange rate of the prepayment. Do I understand that right?
Yes.
And you know, you understand many sophisticated, you know, SAP systems. That's going to be a bit of a challenge to override the sort of shipping date exchange rate. I mean, did you take that into account? I think we did discuss this, and I forget which way we concluded, but I think we did talk about systems issues if you went this way.
Well, obviously that will be one of the things that will be considered, but you know, this if it comes to be a final interpretation, then it will be tied in and won't have an effective date until after IFRS 15 anyway. So things like looking at systems will can be tied in with systems changes that IFRS 15 on revenue might well be introducing as well. But yes,
so I have to say
there will be systems. Yeah.
We didn't pre-discuss it in our group, but I'm not, to be honest, a fan of the option where you've gone. I think I'd rather book the sale at the daily rate of the sale or the monthly rate of the sale, and then if you've got an exchange difference based on the prepayment, you just have exchange difference to book out. But
yeah, the thinking was is that once you've received the cash in advance, say if it is a sale, and you've received the cash in advance, it's then a treasury decision as to do you hold that cash in the foreign currency or do you convert it into your functional currency or do you use it to hedge some other exposures. And that really is a treasury decision as opposed to, you know, you know how much cash, that you know what you've got in terms of that particular sale, so that's the amount that you should be booking as your revenue.
For want of being rude, that's a very Western conclusion, because you might not actually have the treasury ability, because you might not actually be able to move the currency out of the country in which it's based, because you may not have free movement. So, you know, there's another fact and circumstances in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, with restricted currencies, you've got a whole host of issues, of which this is probably just one of them.
It's a very generalised comment that's very European. It's not necessarily applicable for those of us that don't live in Europe or North America.
Sandra?
On page 19, the discussion of income tax uncertainties, under the current position, you indicate that it would only be based on assessments filed with tax authorities. Should it also be expected to be filed in within that year? Because when you do certain transactions, you expect to do a filing or take a position, and you want to include all of the impact of that in one earnings event versus waiting till you actually file, but you have full intent of filing that position at a later date.
Sorry, when we drafted that drafting the proposition, we recognized this point. So when we describe this paragraph, we explain that an entity may use a specific tax treatment in its tax filing, or may use the tax treatment in future tax filings. So okay. It doesn't depend on the timing of tax filings.
Okay, so when you originally book a transaction that you expect that you may have an uncertain tax position and are recording the overall mm-hmm. economic impact, you'll be able to take that into consideration when you do your original booking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Just a very quick point. I think it's just a shorthand. On page 21, you mentioned that entities can account for these investees, like investments in associates, using the equity method or the fair value method. I think it's only certain investment vehicles that can do that. I mean, it's
Exactly. Only those entities which qualify venture capital type of entity. That's it. Yes, exactly.
So I mean, perhaps I just wanted to point out that I haven't that I missed some sort of option in IAS 28.
Any other question to the Taxation Committee? Not the case, then we have a break, and I would